grateful for the turnout on this very important topic, a very timely topic. And if you notice, Gordon Campbell and I looking a little more relaxed now, the speaker has arrived, and we're very comfortable now. Always good to have a little tension in things, though. It makes you sharper sometimes. My name is Bob Campbell. I'll be your moderator for today. We want to, as I say, welcome all of you. We remind you that we want to thank our partners, Shaw TV, Erickson's Restaurant, the Lethbridge Herald, and the University of Lethbridge. We're always appreciative of their support. We remind you that there's baskets at each table, and the cost of the event today is $8, and we would appreciate it if someone at the table would take the responsibility to count the money, make sure it adds up properly. If there's extra, that's not a problem. I think you're all familiar with the format. Our speaker will speak for approximately 25 minutes. We will then have lunch, and then there will be a question period. And we should be out of here by approximately 1:30. Having said all of that, I'll now take the opportunity to introduce our speaker today. As all of you know, even Mr. George Bush concedes that the Americans and Brits got into Iraq for all the wrong reasons. But perhaps, and rightly, he argues it doesn't follow that they should get out because, well, if you break it, it might need to stick around long enough to fix it. Similarly, most Canadians believe that we got into Afghanistan for all of the right reasons, but it doesn't follow that we ought to stay because our presence there might be doing more harm than good. Philosophers of war have had much to say about this conundrum. In brief, this talk will be rehearsing some of what they had to say. Our speaker is Dr. Paul Vinnemitz. Dr. Paul has been a member of the Department of Philosophy at the university since 1997, specializing, and I find this intriguing topic, among other things, the philosophy of war. I didn't realize that war had a philosophy. And so I'm very intrigued by this. In this regard, his most provocative publication is probably his Defense of Terrorism, which, to date at least, has yet to get him arrested when entering either the United States or Great Britain. So with no further ado, we'll please welcoming Dr. Paul Vinnemitz.
I want to apologize. I've given talks here at least three or four times, haven't I, Gord? And my recollection was that we eat first and I talk second. And so I figured, you know, if I'm 5 minutes late for lunch, I mean, but am I wrong about that?
Yes, you
No, but, yeah, I guess so. Actually, I'm on my way on Sunday. I'm flying to London, so there'll be an opportunity to test this hypothesis that I've yet to be arrested, you know, in arriving in. From London to Italy, from Italy to Spain, Spain back to Italy, Italy back to London, London to Pakistan. Now, if I'm not arrested there, then for sure no one's reading the stuff I'm writing. And so. I mention all these travels because, by the way, I'm on sabbatical this year, but I start teaching again in January, and I just telling you this that about my various travels just to make you sick with envy. Trust me, I will not be thinking of you when I'm basking under the Pakistani sun. Well, I won't be thinking of you in Lethbridge at 40 below. Well, Gord has asked me to speak to you for about 20 minutes. Well, actually 25, but apparently I'm late, so it's 20 minutes. I can do it in 20. About Canada's involvement in Afghanistan. But what I have to say about that can probably be said in less than a minute. The just war tradition, that's capitalized, by the way, that putatively constrains the right of one country to invade another insists, among other things, that the cause be a just one, and that there be, as the tradition expresses it, a reasonable prospect of success. You can understand why the tradition has developed that, because you don't want to be going into wars for all the right reasons that you can't possibly succeed in and servicing those reasons. So let's deal with these two conditions in order. I describe myself, for those of you who are in the correct age cohort and female, between wives right now. But let me tell you about my third wife. She was, and remains, as far as I know, just because she's not my wife doesn't mean she's dead, by the way, you know, okay. A feminist philosopher of law and religion. She also happens to be a committed and practicing Christian, and in that regard, she borders on a pacifist. And yet, she advocated the invasion of Afghanistan years before 9/11 on the grounds that a regime that treats half its population worse than we'd allow our ranchers to treat their cattle cannot be tolerated. The reason America and its allies invaded Afghanistan, however, had nothing to do with this. They invaded because the Taliban regime was harboring the resistance against American puppet regimes in the Middle East, and because on 9/11, this resistance had carried that resistance to the shores of America itself. Now, most military ethicists agree that we have a right to make war on those who would make war on us, regardless of who might be to blame in the first place. So it doesn't matter, right? I mean, self-defense doesn't mean you can only defend yourself against somebody who is the aggressor. You can also defend yourself against somebody that you have provoked into aggressing you. And it's a good thing, you know, because most of the people who aggress against us have, in fact, provoked us. But that doesn't mean that we have to just kind of say, okay, you know, it was my fault, so kill me. Right? And most would agree as well with my ex-wife that we have a right to make war on those who would make of half their population cattle to be milked and, should they resist, slaughtered. So let it be granted, for the sake of argument, that our incursion into Afghanistan was a just one. And let it also be granted that we might have had reasons to hope that daisy cutters, by the way, is the kind of nickname for the big bombs that were dropped on some of the mountainsides in Afghanistan during the conquest of Afghanistan. Let's be granted that we might have reason to hope that daisy cutters could achieve what thousands of years of would-be invaders have consistently been unable to achieve, namely a successful invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. In this regard, by the way, Afghanistan historically has been much like Russia. Don't invade it in the winter. You know, Napoleon figured that out, right? Yeah, well, he didn't, but he found out that the hard way. Hitler found out the same thing the hard way. And everybody who's invaded Afghanistan has found out that it doesn't matter winter or summer, don't invade Afghanistan. But the reasonable prospect of success condition, remember that's the second condition, applies at every moment in the invasion and occupation. We now know that daisy cutters cannot achieve what those who came before us could not achieve. Does it follow that we should get out? Well, not if our objectives have changed in the interim. Not if what we want to achieve now is not the installation of a stable, pro-Western Quisling regime, like Karzai, right? But merely the prevention of the installation of a regime, stable or not, that will once again harbor resistance against American puppets in the Middle East. Achieving that objective, however, is likely to be ongoing and cripplingly expensive, both in terms of the ordnance expended and lives lost. Now, that's a call that each occupier is entitled to make. Though in making it for ourselves, as Canadians, we need to consider not just the expense in money and lives, but also the losses we would incur in our trade relations with our allies if, to use Bush's term, we elect to cut and run. Both the Liberals and the Conservatives consulted their bean counters and decided, rightly or wrongly, that 42 deaths, it's still 42, isn't it? 42 deaths over 5 years is not too high a price to pay for Canadians to pay. $2.5 billion recovered from our softwood lumber dispute, remember, divided by 42, comes to just under $60 million per body bag. A bargain by anyone's reckoning, save perhaps the widows of those 42 men. There. That's all I have to say about Canada's involvement in Afghanistan, and it took less than 1 minute. No, it didn't. It took about two. Okay. So what I want to do with the rest of the time allotted to me is explain why we can't hope for any greater victory in Afghanistan than just this. And to this end, I want to give you the abridged version of Military Science 101. It goes like this. Human beings are first and foremost animals. And any animal that doesn't make its first concern to live won't. The way one lives is by not dying. And disease and accidents aside, there are two ways of dying. One can be killed, or one can starve to death. Animals that wait to risk being killed rather than starve to death fare very poorly. Because by the time they see they have a better chance of living by risking being killed, they no longer have the wherewithal to risk being killed. Because they're lying there, starving to death. Now, some human beings, but by no means all, are lucky enough to hope for more than just food and water. They're lucky enough to hope for a quality of life above bare subsistence. The people of the Darfur region in Sudan are not so lucky. Neither are many of the people of Afghanistan. The Palestinians and Iraqi people are this lucky. And many of them are smart. They'd rather risk being killed than submit to an oppressive occupier. I think we should respect that choice. To do otherwise is unseemly. In other words, make war if you must. And I am not a pacifist. I am not, nor am I even one, a person who says you can only go to war in self-defense. I'm a militant. So make war if you must. But respect your enemy. He's fighting for something of as much value to him as what you're fighting for is to you. Now, let me explain how a battle works. I know from personal experience. I've been there. My battle line will break and cede the field to the victor when and only when I judge the probability of my being killed if I hold my position is greater than the probability of my being killed if I turn tail and run. But if what I have to run to is either no food or intolerable oppression, I'll be more inclined to hold my position. This is why it doesn't pay to mistreat prisoners of war or to mistreat a vanquished people. It makes victory very expensive for the victor in terms of his own body count, because obviously he's going to lose a lot more of his men trying to get me than otherwise. But these same principles apply to the enemy's recruitment of those willing to fight in the first place. If the probability of my being killed if I take up arms and fight is less than the probability of my being killed or starved to death if, unlike Bill in the, is it Johnny Cash song, Don't Take Your Guns to Town, Bill? Yeah. If, unlike Bill, I don't take my guns to town, then the most rational thing for me to do is to take up arms. Because remember, our first premise, the axiom driving military science is we want to stay alive. And now we're beginning to see why famine, or just oppression, breeds the taking up of arms. In virtually every conflict in human history, including the wars in Darfur, Palestine, Iraq, and Afghanistan, one is considerably more likely to be killed by a soldier than as a soldier. Think about that. And one is orders of magnitude more likely to be starved to death by a soldier than as one. This is why very few young boys in places like the Darfur need to be press ganged into picking up a rifle. When the food drops arrive, when the UN drops the food drops, okay, it is those with rifles who eat first. Those without, often not at all. And the same can be said of Palestine, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The resistance fighters in all three of these occupied lands are at the top of the Maslow hierarchy. What victims of daisy cutters or conventional shelling call terrorism, those dropping the bombs or firing the shells call
collateral damage. But this is a fatuous distinction to those on the ground. If one's village is being razed, discretion eventually proves the better part of patience, and one takes up arms, not to risk one's life, but to preserve it. And this, at long last, is why we cannot win in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan is one that cannot be prosecuted without inflicting enormous collateral damage, which just is, for those on the receiving end, terrorism. And that terrorized people cannot accede to the demands of those terrorizing them if there remains those in their midst who have chosen not to accede to those demands. Now, aspersions of using civilians as human shields is a occupier's propaganda. Of course, they'd have, that is to say, the occupier, would have the enemy meet them on open ground where they can be dispatched with a single cluster bomb. Duh. We'd all like that, wouldn't we? But that is not how one avoids being killed. And what war is about, remember, is avoiding being killed. So we cannot win our war against the Afghan resistance any more than America can win its war against the Iraqi resistance, or Israel can win its war against the Palestinian resistance, save, of course, by a program of genocide. The more we fight the Afghanis, in the way in which we have to fight them, the more Afghanis there will be to fight. So, where does that leave us? Well, as already noted, if, like the Americans, we're prepared to stay the course, then we should be prepared for a lot more of our sons coming back in body bags. In a similar conflict, Vietnam, the Americans welcomed home 55,000 such bags over the course of 12 years. In the end, they did not achieve even their more modest objective of retreating with dignity. When the Canadians leave Afghanistan in another 3 years, and if we're lucky with only another 42 body bags, we'll console ourselves that it was a job well done, notwithstanding that we'll have killed another 100,000 Afghanis in the process. But, we'll tell ourselves, being Taliban fighters, many of them were legitimate targets, notwithstanding that most of these fighters were, in fact, simply villagers trying to defend themselves and their villages and their families, and wouldn't have known the difference between a Taliban fighter and an English hedgehog. Now, what the Afghan resistance are resisting, we're told, is interference in their husbandry of their women. One wonders, however, what these women would have to say on the subject. One wonders, for example, how many of these women might be, like their men, first and foremost animals, concerned to preserve their lives and those of their children before turning their attention to tossing their burqas. One wonders, but of course, one is hard-pressed to ask them. So, is it time to get out of Afghanistan? Well, I'm not sure. I think that on this matter, I would defer to my ex-wife. But I suspect she'd be the first to point out that after 5 years of a brutal occupation, there are more women who have been buried in their burqas than have tossed them. Thanks.